Jeremiah chapter 14, and look at verse number 14. Then said the Lord unto me, the prophets prophesy lies in my name. I send them not, neither have I commanded them, neither spake unto them. They prophesy unto you a false vision of divination and a thing of naught and the deceit of their heart. Then I'd like you to go to one more verse. Go to John chapter 3. Go to John chapter 3. Look at verse number 7. Marvel not that I said unto thee, ye must be born again. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. And then there's a colon there, so is everyone that is born of the Spirit. So the wind that's blowing there and the movement is the movement of the Holy Spirit. And here God says nobody controls that. You don't know where the power of God is going to fall. When I teach on revival, there is national revival where God pours out His Spirit on an area of a country or on a country. There is also personal revival. Last week we got to look at the Great Awakening. And the Great Awakening was a time when Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield, and from 1734 kicked off with Jonathan Edwards, and then in 1741, I told you about Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It goes down in history as the most famous sermon preached in America. Okay, and it's the one probably most people have read and things, and it's good, and I read you a portion of it. When God poured out His Spirit in the Great Awakening, God had to do something in America to pull America together. We were 13 colonies. Each colony, except for Rhode Island and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, had an established church. In the North, it was the Congregationalist. North Carolina is Presbyterian. And you have a whole bunch of Virginia is going to be Episcopalian and the established church in England. And so you've got 13 colonies that before we fight Britain have to come together. What did God use to bring us together? Because 1741 is 30 years roughly from the Revolutionary War, right? We're getting ready to go against the world's, at that time, the strongest military power in the world. Something has to bring us together, and guess what God chose? Revival. So God starts it with the Great Awakening. And as we look at that, you say, and then we're going to get into tonight, I'm going to show you the separate Baptist revival, which is called the greatest revival in the history of America, and many would say in the history of the world. And I'll tell you why later. You say, but wait a second, you mentioned last week the Fulton Street revival and the Welsh revival, and those are revivals that when you ask your average Christian, that goes to a Bible preaching church that's interested in revival, they're going to tell you, normally, the first revival that they're going to say is the Great Awakening. Then they're going to move to the camp meetings in America. And they'll go to James McGreedy, Presbyterian, early 1800s, 1803, in Kentucky. But there's something you need to know about those revivals. Other than what we're going to look at tonight, there was nothing weird about George Whitefield's, how God used him and his power in America. There was nothing wrong with that. But when you get into the other revivals, listen closely. In James McGreedy's revival, in camp meeting, they said, you know, and then I wrote the names down here. Barton Stone at the Cane Ridge camp meeting. All churches were invited for ecumenical purposes. This is in August of 1801. There were 800 people at that camp meeting that were struck insensible for 8 to 10 minutes to 8 to 10 hours. You ever seen people, you know, we talk about it being, you know, Pentecostal, slain in the Spirit, whatever. That's not found in the Bible, but that was happening at the camp meeting in Kentucky. that everybody says, oh, that's the first camp meeting in America. No, that was not the first camp meeting in America, and I'm so glad it wasn't. The man we're going to look at tonight had the first camp meeting in America, Shubal Stearns. So in 18, did you know, then people talk about, oh, well, D.L. Moody, as he saw over a million people saved, and Billy Sunday. Did you know D.L. Moody was congregational? Did you know D.L. Moody was never baptized after he was saved? Did you know not one of D.L. Moody's converts were baptized, follow the Lord in believer's baptism, after they were saved? Did you know that? He didn't do his work through a church. He would do his work with the horse and wagons in Chicago, and literally he recruited many. It was not a church work. And D.L. Moody would have question and answer periods in his revivals, and he would, in his revivals, and he, and people would ask, what is our doctrinal position on baptism? And it's on record, he would skirt those questions and never answer them. Did you know Billy Sunday saw over a million people saved? And I'm glad he did. Billy Sunday, you know. Did you know Billy Sunday was never baptized after he was saved? Did you know Billy Sunday and all those people he saw saved never had one person baptized? Never one of his converts followed the Lord in believer's baptism. Now, if I just stopped right there, if we call that revival, have you ever thought about what you're calling revival? Okay, let me ask you a question. Would you go hear a Bible preacher preach? What would you think it's not going to happen, but let's just go there in our minds real quick. What would you think if we had somebody here and I said, yes, this guy's been a preacher for about 20 years and man, he's got a big church. Now, there's one drawback. He's never followed the Lord in believer's baptism, but he's here tonight and would you listen to him? How come? Because baptism's important, isn't it? But yet we'll lift up D.L. Moody, we'll lift up Billy Sunday, and oh, those were great preachers. They weren't evil men, and I can think of worse things to do with your time. Steel hubcaps. they weren't evil, wicked people, but at the same time, it's absolutely amazing to me who we lift up as far as heroes. Did you know in the Fulton Street Revival, that was an ecumenical meeting in 1857. 10,000 people right around there. You know, I told you about the revival. People were getting saved, but it was an ecumenical meeting. Did you know the Welsh revival? And I have the man's name of what they call the man that was Evan Roberts in the Welsh revival of 1904 to 1905 in Welsh England. He said God told him and prophesied that God told him not to speak for 6 days. And then at the end of 6 days, Evan Roberts said, God said, you can't speak for 7 days, now Satan can't speak for 7 days. Okay, God does not speak outside of His Word. God doesn't do extra biblical revelation, but in the Welsh revival, within 7 days of this, they had so extra biblical prophecy is happening. Churches in England were exchanging pastors, so they could break down denominational barriers. In other words, it doesn't matter what denomination you are. Why don't you come over here and preach at this church, and you go over there? And they were doing it all over. Then at the end of the 7 days, they said they had women preachers preaching on the street with the men. If I were to take the revivals of what we would call of the past, can I just ask you a question? I think I have a scriptural right. Remember the camp meetings with James McGreedy? Okay, I wrote his name down. Yeah, Barton Stone. Not only were 800 people laying down, there were over, have y'all ever heard of Peter Cartwright, the Methodist preacher that was the traveling preacher? Okay. He was Methodist. He said he saw over 500 people with the jerks. He didn't see 500 jerks. He saw 500 people with jerks. I thought that was funny. Okay. So he saw these people, and this is how they described in the camp meeting in Kentucky, people with the jerks were shaking their head side to side and sometimes unstoppably. Okay. When that happens in Hinduism, that's demon possession. That's been happening a long time. It said also people would roll. They would do rolling exercises at this camp meeting in Kentucky. They would drop to the floor and then roll. You know, whee! Don't do that. Then, wah, there's a hill over there. Okay. The weirdest thing was the barking exercises. It said the men, some of the men, not all, but some of the men would get on all fours and bark. Roof, 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 until they were hoarse, and then they couldn't bark anymore. Now let me ask you a question. When you describe revivals of the past, anything that takes place that is not in the Bible is wrong. That's why I think I would have a question. I have a question as a Baptist because the Bible's important to me and to us. Were those revivals really of God? I have a tendency to say not, no. When you start getting into them, there were all types of disturbing, unbiblical manifestations. I don't believe it's right. But the Holy Spirit, do you realize what was taking place in the Brownsville revival, quote unquote, in Florida? They took the barking. This just happened in the 90s, like 20 years ago or something, 25 something years ago. It said people were barking like a dog, roof, 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 and then they were doing clucking. And then it went further into, this is all in the name of revival. Then people were getting Holy Ghost laughter and then finally they started calling it a drunkenness where you act drunk. And don't watch the videos. I saw a few videos about a month ago of it. It's disturbing. Like it's scary to me. I don't like that because that's not in the Bible. That's carried over to today. What we're going to look at tonight, I think, is the greatest, I don't know why it's not spoken of more, but it's the greatest revival, I think, on American history. There'll be stories of people weeping. There'll be stories of people falling to their knees and repenting and getting saved, but there's no weird stuff happen. When you study the Baptists and the Baptist revivals, stuff outside the Bible isn't there. It's happening in church. People are following the Lord and believers' baptism after they get saved, and then they're going soul winning. So that's what we're going to look at tonight. During the Great Awakening, what might help you is, before we dive into this, during the Great Awakening, with George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards in England, in Massachusetts, in those 10, 12 years, the number of Baptist churches went from 6 to 30. 6 to 30. In Connecticut, the number of Baptist churches during just the Great Awakening went from 4 to 12. In Rhode Island, the number of Baptist churches went from 11 to 36. We describe revival in not just the way a Protestant, hopefully we all know the difference between Protestant and Baptist. A Protestant describes revival when quote unquote people are getting saved. A Baptist does not do that. And I'll tell you why. When Jesus gave us the Great Commission, it's three parts. It's not one. We're to get people saved, get them baptized, and teach them all things whatsoever the Lord has commanded us. We're to teach them. You say, well, let's take them soul winning. It's soul winning, it's church attendance, it's tithing, it's all of that. Teach them to be faithful in what the Lord's taught us. When a Protestant, because they don't baptize right, listen, a Protestant only observes the first commandment, the first part of the Great Commission. Did you know a Baptist is the only one that can obey all three parts? If you're sprinkling babies and you're calling that baptism, then you're not obeying the Great Commission. We're the only ones that get people saved, baptized by immersion, and then do the third part. You say, what's our follow-up program? We've got a great follow-up program, but it starts with Sunday school. And somebody that won't come to Sunday school, you can't get them to grow. You understand? And that starts it. Here, now let's look at One more thing, and then we'll get started on this. John Clark is the pastor of the First Baptist Church in America. 1738, and then 1739, he comes to Rhode Island, and he moves it down to the bottom. While John Clark is preaching, Obadiah Holmes, remember the man that was whipped? He becomes his assistant pastor. Obadiah Holmes then reaches a man named Valentine Whiteman. Valentine Whiteman, word Whiteman. I've mentioned the Whitemans two times, but Valentine Whiteman ends up being a descendant of Edward Whiteman, the last man burned at the stake in England, April 11, 1612. One of his brothers comes over here to America, and Valentine Whiteman is related to him. And Obadiah Holmes gets to see him saved and baptized. Then Valentine Whiteman starts planting churches in Connecticut. And in Connecticut, he plants a church there in North Stonington, Connecticut in 1743. And Waite Palmer becomes the first pastor there, and he pastors that church for 22 years. Waite Palmer, so it goes John Clark, if you're looking at a timeline, John Clark, Obadiah Holmes, Valentine Whiteman, now he's in Connecticut. Valentine Whiteman baptizes and gets Waite Palmer saved and teaches him to preach and all that. And he pastors this church in North Stonington, Connecticut. And then he reaches Shubal Stearns. Shubal Stearns, we're going to find out, was saved by watching George Whitefield preach as he preached all along the coast here in America. Now, there are 12 outstanding men in the forming of our country here in America. Only four of them were politicians. Okay? I've told you about George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, but in order of influence, you have Shubal Stearns. You have Samuel Harris. We'll learn about him, but if you've never heard about him, he's the Apostle of Virginia. Before West Virginia broke and before parts of Virginia became what we know as Kentucky and Tennessee, this man, Samuel Harris, was saved out of this revival I'm getting ready to tell you and planted 50 churches in Virginia. He's the Apostle of Virginia. Great man. You say, I've never heard of him. There'll be several men. Watch this. John Clark, I've already told you, the pastor of the First Baptist Church in America, and yet from his church would come the First Baptist churches in several colonies, not all of them, but several. Then Roger Williams, I've told you about him. George Washington, very important man. Very important man. We'll teach you about him. Isaac Bacchus was born in 1724, had a great wife, Susanna. She was born the same year, and they had 9 children, great family. Who was Isaac Bacchus? Isaac Bacchus ends up being the most influential pen in America. He wrote through the 1700s, as America was forming First Continental Congress, and as our country was forming its government, about religious liberty, and what he recorded was in his history books, where was persecution taking place in Connecticut and Massachusetts, and when James Madison, John Adams, and Samuel Adams were saying, persecution isn't that big. Isaac Bacchus was standing up at the Continental Congress going, sirs, it's bigger than you can imagine. It's a violation of my conscience. And when our forefathers were learning the importance of separating church and state, Isaac Bacchus was the man who was standing up, writing page after page. He was speaking with the men. And so everybody needs to know, I think, who Isaac Bacchus was because of the forming of our country. And then, of course, Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, James Madison, and that's going to be the Bill of Rights. And then John Leland, we'll learn about him, but John Leland ends up being the greatest preacher in this area. The man we're going to learn about tonight is Shubal Stearns. They say two things. Shubal Stearns baptized the South, and John Leland was the Baptist preacher who baptized the North from Virginia up. Very influential. And most of these men, like I told you, only four of these were politicians. And I made those in black. That's George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Patrick Henry. The rest of them are preachers. The rest of them. Now I know as far as Roger Williams. And once you start understanding this, I hope it helps you with our country's outline. Now let's get into the story here of the greatest revival in America. Ready? This is Carolina's Baptist history. Evangelist Paul Palmer. He started the First Baptist Church in Cowan County, 10 miles north of Eddington, in 1727. He was a General Baptist, and by 1755, all the General Baptist churches would be reconstructed by the regular Baptists. What's happening is Calvinism has always been a poison. In other words, some people they teach, you know, you're predestined to heaven or predestined to hell, and you don't have to go soul winning, and it just kills a church. That's a battle in the country right now, okay? Calvinism and not, and it's infectious teaching. William Screven, a regular Baptist, started the First Baptist Church in Charleston, South Carolina in 1683 after he was persecuted in Boston, Massachusetts, and Kittery, Maine. With George Whitfield, there's a picture of George preaching to the multitudes in his outdoor meeting. Schubel Stearns was an obscure New England Congregationalist, and he was awakened or saved under the preaching of George Whitfield, who became a separate Baptist, not George Whitfield, but Schubel Stearns. He became a separate Baptist in Tolland, Connecticut. George Whitfield was funny. He never changed his position on baptism. Matter of fact, he was getting angry at his converts. People were getting saved literally by the thousands. But what was frustrating is, you know, he couldn't go into the Anglican churches here in America because they wouldn't let him. But his converts, they were getting saved. The power of God was falling. And then listen what was happening. They would go home, read their Bible, and then they would start going, where's infant baptism in the Bible? It's not here. Well, we need to separate. So they started calling, not separate Baptists, that would come later, but they started calling them the separates. Because they're getting saved and they're leaving their congregational churches and they're forming separate churches. You see what's getting ready to happen? Schubel Stearns is saved in 1745. He was 39 years old. And who was Schubel Stearns? He was born in Boston. He married Sarah Johnson. He was saved during Whitfield's 1745 tour of Connecticut. Schubel and his family were immersed by Waite Palmer in Stonington, Connecticut in March of 1751. Then Waite Palmer ordained Schubel Stearns in 1751, and Joshua Morse helped Pastor Waite Palmer ordain Schubel Stearns, and then Daniel and Martha Marshall received believer's baptism by the hand of Samuel Heaton at Mill Creek Church in 1740. Let me just describe this to you real quick. In 1751, Daniel Marshall is the same age as Schubel Stearns. Daniel Marshall is stirred by hearing George Whitfield preach. And he said, Jesus is coming. And so Daniel Marshall sells his house, takes his family, but he starts ministering to the Indians. And back then they believed the Indians didn't have any souls. Daniel Marshall said, Jesus is coming. I think God wants me to preach to the heathen. And Daniel Marshall and his wife, they start ministering to the Indians. And the Indians, the Mohawks, you ever heard of the Mohawks? They're up there and they end up having a war. And Daniel and his wife end up leaving. And over here, have you all heard of Winchester, Virginia? Near Winchester, Mill Creek is where they come. Daniel Marshall and Schubel Stearns come down from Connecticut. And they try to minister to the Indians there. And they know God has something for them, and they're a few years. In 1755, Schubel Stearns gets a letter. And it says in the letter, down here in North Carolina, people will travel 40 miles to hear one sermon. Now, if you're on horseback, do you realize that's a 2 to 3 day journey? Schubel Stearns hears that. Let's back up. About 30 years before that, George Whitfield goes through North Carolina. He's seeing people, and I described his revival to you last week. He's seeing people saved literally by the thousands. But when he gets to North Carolina, only a few hundred people attend in a couple of places. George Whitfield gets so frustrated, and about 1744, right 30 miles north of New Bern, he gets off of his horse, and this is what he says. He prays a prayer, and he says, Lord, please send a John the Baptist to this wilderness and convert these heathen, because he considered North Carolina the biggest waste in America. Because everywhere he went, did you know he came through here in Maryland? He came through here in Maryland, and I mean, thousands of people were coming to him. He was preaching 2 and 3 times a day. And then he would go to the next spot. He worked his way through Connecticut and then Delaware, worked his way down Maryland, worked his way through Virginia. He was working his way along the coast. And when he got to North Carolina, it just, the crowds went, well, wait, he said, there's people here, but nobody comes to hear. And he prayed. You know what he was praying? He was praying, and God answered George Whitfield's prayer to send a John the Baptist to North Carolina. And guess who God used to answer that call? Schubel Stearns. As much as George Whitfield hated the Baptists, he was praying that God would send a Baptist to North Carolina. And so Schubel Stearns gets this letter while they're over here near just north of Winchester. And it says, if you'll come down here, people in a 100-mile radius of Liberty, North Carolina, which is near Sandy Creek, he said, people will travel over 40 miles to hear one sermon. Can you imagine that? If we said, hey, there's some great preaching over there in Arizona. Let's all get in the church van. Probably not. Okay. However, back then, to get in a wagon with horse, they would do that. Schubel Stearns and his wife Sarah, his parents, Schubael and Rebecca Stearns, his brothers, Peter Stearns and Ebenezer Stearns, and their wives, Joseph Breed and his wife, Ena Stimson and his wife, and Jonathan Polk and wife, begin the journey to the south. 16 people go from West Virginia over here. They take the journey. Right in here is Liberty. And this road here is one of the great roads that went through America, kind of from here, from the north to the south. And this is the road they took, and they come to Liberty. And just so you know, you want to hear a beautiful story? When you read the story of these, of our forefathers, James Reed could not, R-E-E-D, he could not read. So when he got saved, his wife took the Bible and taught him to read. And he later becomes a preacher. But I just thought that was a sweet story. On November 22nd, Sandy Creek, 1755, Sandy Creek is organized. Schubel Stearns had no formal degree, but a brilliant mind. He was greatly gifted in organizational skills. The picture there, it does show you that he was known as a man of very short stature. He was very short. His speaking ability, they said he spoke in musical tones. In other words, his voice was very easy to listen to, and it says he reached emotions. He went straight for the heart when he preached, and it says he fetched tears from the eyes. And it says he's preaching here with those 16 people that come down to North Carolina. He envisioned a workforce to quickly plant a large number of churches. Within 2 years, these 16 people that are here would not be in his church anymore. They would be out pastoring. They did not plant their first church for a year. They got established. They got their families established, but they knew where they were going. Schubel Stearns had this vision that God was going to call men out of his church to preach, and that's how he started working it. They had two assistant pastors there, Daniel Marshall and Joseph Breed. Why would you have two assistant pastors if you have a church of 16? Does that sound goofy? It's not if you're training pastors to go out and plant churches. And that's why when people look at the Sandy Creek Baptist Church, they're thinking, two assistant pastors, 16 people. In 2 years, this church would grow to 606. In 2 years, it would grow to 600 people. In 3 years, it would grow to 900. 900. 3 years later, they're running 900, and they hold the first camp meeting in America. They've now started planting churches, and the three churches that are out there come back to Sandy Creek, and they have the first church multi-meeting, and Schubel Stearns is helping them, and they would spend a week there with preaching and prayer meetings at night. And yes, no, the Presbyterians were not the first ones. 40 years before the Presbyterians, we were on the stick. Amen. When we went to Sandy Creek and we took some pictures, When you pull up on the property there, the two monuments there are to the Sandy Creek Separate Baptist Church there. There's the monument where the site of the original church was, and as you get closer to it, it says, in this on this site, November to December 1755, Schubel Stearns, his wife, and those who came with him, seven other families, 16 souls in all, built their first meeting house where they administered the Lord's Supper. It says here, from this site, her converts were as drops of morning dew and literally would start covering the country. Seymour York, his tombstone is out there, and he is the one who dedicated and gave the land for Sandy Creek Baptist Church in 1756. They did not build a building when they started their church for 3 years. They were so used to preaching outside. Now, they would make a covering for the preacher, and then they would all stand, and I mean, as the church grew, okay, everybody look at this building. That's not going to hold 600 people. This was built in 1945. See the metal roof? They didn't have metal roofs back then. This is a size-type church that was like what Schubel Stearns had. Wait till you see the inside of it. Here, as you're coming up to the door, as you walk into the church, here's the platform, and there's rows of here, but do you all see the balcony? And a lot of churches were built that way. Even though their auditorium was smaller than ours, they would see this as wasted space. And they didn't have air conditioning. But almost all of them, they would say, okay, we can seat this many people, and if we put some seating along there, boy, wouldn't that drive the code crazy. Okay, they'd shut us down like yesterday. But when you go into this church at Sandy Creek, this is back in the 1750s now, as you get closer to it, when you look over to the right, there was a little, you know, staircase that's going up this balcony. It went all the way around. It's about a 26 by 32 room. It's not big. Then when you look over to the left of the pulpit, there's the pews over there. And then I took one picture from the pulpit looking out with a few rows, and they had a center aisle down there. They didn't meet in that building, and they didn't build it until 3 years after they got there. They were going out. They would meet, and then, I mean, men are being called to preach. They're going out and planting churches. This gets built 3 years later. This is Schubel Stearns' gravesite. It says he died in November 20th, 1771, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that here in just a second, okay? So there was his gravesite, and I have these pictures. No, I'm not going to read all this to you, but this is the honoring of the Sandy Creek Baptist Church. When we were there, it was so sad. A Southern Baptist pastor and his wife were there. You know, here I am with my family, and I'm just in awe. I'm just, wow, this is really great to be here. And I walked up to the pastor, and I said, do you know where, I said, what do you know of this place? And this is what he said. He said, well, this was the first Baptist church in North Carolina. And I was like, nah. And I didn't correct him. I just wanted to know what he knew. I said, do you know about the revival that took place here? He said, what revival? He said, this is just the first place in North Carolina where there was a Baptist church. I said, you don't know about the revival? And so I started telling him. He was like, oh, well, maybe that's why this place is so important. But he didn't know. He didn't know what took place. All he was thinking of was that it was the place of the first Baptist church in North Carolina. And so they've got these monuments there, and they're put there by the Baptist History Preservation Society. And there's another of the monuments. The First Baptist Church, from this church in Sandy Creek, in basically a 17 or 16 year ministry, Schubel Stearns would have 125 men called to preach under his preaching. From that little church would come 42 other churches in 15 years, 42 churches. Then the first separate Baptist church in South Carolina, not the first Baptist church, the first separate Baptist church that's going soul winning would appear in South Carolina. They would go south. The first separate Baptist church in Virginia, in Delaware, Kentucky, Georgia, and from this church also would also come the first church in Tennessee with Tidens Lane, once Tidens Lane gets saved. This little church here, see, we measure revival, if you aren't careful, and I there's a couple of things I'd like you to leave here tonight. We measure revival, Baptists do, by churches. You see, a Sunday school teacher's call to fame, listen closely, is how many times can your class split? Right? How many times can your class get too big for your room, and then we have to get another teacher in there, and it splits, and then your class gets big again? And a lot of people go, oh, the pastor's taking my kids! A sign of success is how many people can you reach? We apply that until we get to the church. And then all of a sudden, you see, you multiply by dividing. We know that's true in Sunday school. But when we come to a church, all of a sudden we start thinking, well, maybe someday we can tear this building down and we'll build a bigger building. They didn't think that way. That's mega church thinking. Watch this. I'm all for doing it if God allows us to do that. Do you understand? But way Baptists have thought is this. When can our church plant another church? When can somebody who's called to preach in our church support them and help them as they plant another church? But do you know who? Hardly anybody thinks that way. In our crowd, and I wish it wasn't so, but in our crowd, your church is great based on its size. How many people can you put on one location? But do you realize if Maryland's reached, it's not reached by one church. It's not reached by one big church. If Maryland's going to be reached, it'll be reached the same way the Separate Baptist Revival happened, by churches going out. By going out. And then I'm going to say one more thing that's going to rock the boat. If more people had the attitude that I'm having right now, that I'm trying to show you, it would cut down all church fights. What are you doing running a bus up here or a bus over here? That's my area. That's our church's area. Aren't we all on the same team? Aren't we all supposed to be reaching as many people as we can? And if somebody leaves our church, I'm glad they go to another church. What hurts the cause of Christ is when they leave our church and quit church. We don't have enough of anything. Do you understand? And I think if more people had this attitude versus, no, I'm trying to make this place big. Well, I don't mind making this place big. And nobody's going to stand at the door going, we're too big, you have to go somewhere else. We don't do that. And nor do I think it's wrong to be a big church. But instead of walking onto the property thinking, wow, Lord, one day when are you going to give us a 1,000-seat auditorium? I wish we'd be praying this. Lord, one day our church is going to get to plant another church. Did you know Brother Connor said from his church to the south end of South Maryland, he said there is no independent fundamental soul winning. He said there's nothing. No, there's room around here to plant churches. There's room. We're not covering it all. We are not reaching all of Southern Maryland. And when you get that type of mindset, it's healthy. And it keeps, watch this, it keeps us from bickering with other churches. Well, we were going to run a bus route there first. Well, I tell you what, why don't we both run buses, and then we'll get them thinking if they get on our bus that, you know, they're riding the nice bus and all that, but really we're getting them to church and teaching them how to get saved and how to grow in the Lord. Wouldn't that be good? That's totally different. Now, let's keep on going here, and I need to hurry, okay? From this church here, they go out in, watch what happens, and I'm almost done. The first generation church plants. The first church, the second church is Abbott's Creek. Daniel Marshall starts that. Then Grassy Creek with James Reed. Same year. Now, this is a year after they've been there. Then and the fourth church planted is Deep River. Joseph Murphy and Philip Mulkey, they go plant that church. New River is 17. These are all the churches in North Carolina. Little River, Black River, Trent, Southwest, Hall River, Shallow Fords, Lockwood's Folly, 1772, okay, all the way up there. This church right here, Little River, ends up, Little River grew to 500 members in 3 years. Little River had 4 branch churches in 10 years, Little River 2, Rocky River, Jones Creek, and Mountains Creek. Next, watch this. This church, Hall River, from 1765 to 1772, basically in 7 years, grew to 5 branches in 7 years. That church was able to divide 5 times in 7 years. Now you understand why they call this the greatest revival in American history, and possibly the greatest revival in the world. Churches, people are getting saved, they're following the Lord and believers' baptism, and churches are being multiplied. It's not just people getting saved. And I'm not against it, but people getting saved has never been a standard for Baptists saying we're having revival. Although I do think it's a great miracle. So I'm not minimizing that. So don't take this too far. Watch what happens. Ready? That's in North Carolina. In South Carolina, the ninth church planted is Fair Forest, the Congaree Church in 1766. Stevens Creek, 1762. They go up into Virginia. These churches are planted. Samuel Harris starts planting one in 1769, and then they go down into Georgia. Daniel Marshall is coming to the end of his life. He has his son Abraham Marshall that came down from Connecticut. Daniel Marshall goes to Congaree and plants six more churches in Georgia, the penal colony. Remember where Britain would bring their hope you make it and hope you die, or we don't care. You know, they'd shove you off the ship. This was low life. Georgia was a bad place to be, and the Baptists said, we go to the other side of the tracks, we'll go anywhere. And the Baptists started the first Baptist church in of any type in Georgia. And then Daniel Marshall becomes the apostle of Georgia. Beautiful story. Him, his son, and his grandson pastor for 60 years, the same church at Congaree, while planting churches all through Georgia. And then they go up into Virginia there. That would be part of modern-day Kentucky and Tennessee. Now, in 1770, the Sandy Creek Baptist Association splits into three. In 1771 is the War of the Regulators. Okay, what do we know about North Carolina? Does everybody see New Bern right there? New Bern was the capital of the colony at the time, Governor William Tryon. William Tryon was a horrible, vile man. He was the representative from England. He is the one who disannulled, he hated the Baptists. He disannulled all the Baptist marriages. Because people are getting saved. Revival's breaking out in North Carolina, and Tryon tries to stop it. It is the only religious cleansing. He takes his soldiers and goes through North Carolina and does the only religious cleansing in American history. In 1771, well, a little bit before that, let me just tell you about this. He disannulled every Baptist's marriage. He said, if you're a Baptist and you're not Presbyterian, which is what North Carolina was, your marriage is disannulled and your wife is a whore. The Baptist had it up to here. Okay? You don't call my wife a whore. It's time we're putting on the gloves. The regulators, it's the story of the War of the Regulators at Alamance, just a little bit from from Sandy Creek, about 30 miles north, the Battle of Alamance takes place. The soldiers, the mainly Baptists, came over the mountain here, and they're all getting ready to fight Governor William Tryon, as he has both armies have 2,000 men. It lasted 2.5 hours. 9 people died from each side, and the regulators lost. They surrendered because Governor Tryon had 8 field artillery pieces. Okay? You would thought more people would have died with that, but Deacon Benjamin Merrill ends up being a hero. Many heroes in that war. However, this is the first war of America's independence. This is 1771. 1776 would take place. Okay? So this ends up being the first, confrontational, where they square off. And then the regulators, they were a militia, they weren't a trained army, they surrender. Benjamin Merrill and 5 others are taken to Hillsborough, North Carolina, and the governor ordered them. Benjamin Merrill was a Baptist deacon at the church there in North Carolina, one of the headquarters of the regulators, and Governor Tryon was on his religious cleansing. He ordered Benjamin Merrill to be, when he was hung, when they dropped, he was to be cut down before he died. This is on the, this is also in the records there. They then cut his bowels open. They took his entrails out in front of him while he was still living, lit them on fire, and when he died, they cut off his head, cut his body into four pieces, and sent it all over North Carolina. And Governor Tryon, there were six men that were hung that day. How many have ever heard of Alamance? Okay, one. Okay, my boys. You were born in there? You have? Have you seen the place where the six men were hung? It's caged there, right outside. It says, this position, these six men were hung. This is how it all ends. It ends up splitting. Schubel Stearns dies that same year. The year before that, he didn't know how to handle it. Keep in mind, do you all see where the mother church is compared to where the battle's getting ready to take place? The only thing he knew was Romans 12:18, if at all possible, live peaceably with all men. But he had men in his church that were saying, Governor Tryon disannulled our marriage. Preacher, what do we do? I'm taking up a gun. And so Schubel Stearns gets up and says, if any man takes up arms, he didn't know what to do. I don't think he knew Baptist history like we do. The only thing he knew was pacifist. You understand? And he made the decree, if any man takes up arms against the government, he'll be excommunicated from this church. It caused the church to split. It split into three directions. Once Governor Tryon's bloodbath takes place in North Carolina, listen closely, God used the churches that were planted there and 1,500 families, 6,000 people head over the mountains into Tennessee and to Kentucky. Titans Lane plants churches, the first church in Kentucky. The first church, as far as you understand, every time we're persecuted, we always go elsewhere. By 1800, I'm all done. By 1800, when he dies, 42 churches have been planted. By 1800, 1,000 churches have come out of Sandy Creek Baptist Church, and by 1825, 2,000 churches. This is the great, that's why North Carolina to this day, when you go there, there are more churches. There's a church on every corner, isn't there? It's more churches per capita than any other state in America. Do you know why? It comes back to the greatest revival in America. This is what made the South the Bible Belt. It was this preaching. It was the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. And I'm going to close with this. Revival happens when God pours out His Spirit. I think sometimes our problem is we're satisfied with too little. Oh, good, souls are getting saved. We must be having revival. No, God's still in the soul-saving business. But that's not this revival. You understand? That's not the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. I hope tonight this is looking at, let's go ahead and turn on the lights. This is looking at the greatest revival in America. If you would like, I have this book.